chanter.
Just wait.
May it please the court, my name is Yvette Robertson White, and I represent the secretary in this matter. Along with me today is Deputy Assistant General Counsel Edward V. Cassidy, Jr. I'd like to ask the indulgence of the court while I submit a chart to you due to the complexity of this case. I've already submitted to Dr. Osmond as well as to the amicus in order to explain the framework of Chapter 35 and how it works in reference to this case.
No objection.
Maximum entitlement. It is the Secretary's position that this case presents a question of law and it can be decided by the court de novo. Maximum entitlement to educational benefits for all eligible veterans and dependents were extended from 36 to 45 months. In 1976, when the Senate extended DEA for dependents, it made this pronouncement. In 2006, the legislator spoke once again and specifically stated in 38 U.S.C. Section 3511 that no matter if you were eligible based on one or more of the provisions of 38 U.S.C. Section 3501, you are only entitled to 45 months of assistance. This is the hallmark of the case before us.
Can I go back to that?
You certainly may.
3511A1, first sentence is what you're referring to.
Yes.
Each eligible person shall be entitled to educational assistance not in excess of 45 months. Is there a second sentence after that? Am I reading this right? In no event may the aggregate educational assistance afforded to a spouse made eligible under two provisions of this title exceed 45 months?
At the time when Dr. Osmond filed his case, yes, that's exactly what the statute stated.
All right. And when it said that, why would that be necessary if, in fact, you were limited to 45 months, regardless of how you got your eligibility or multiple eligibilities under the statute? Otherwise stated, it limits it to 45 months for a surviving spouse who could have eligibility under two provisions. Why would that be needed if you were limited to 45 months, regardless of multiple eligibility status?
I believe in that particular situation, you could have the spouse could have been eligible in two different respects. You could have gotten it either through the death.
Yeah, specifically refers to eligibility for disability of your spouse and then eligibility for disability or death of your spouse. And there are two routes to eligibility, and Congress said, whoops, we want to limit that to 45. But wouldn't that mean that if you had two routes to eligibility elsewise under that statute, there was no limitation?
That there wasn't a limitation?
That there was no limitation.
Well, I believe there was a limitation. And let me explain to you why. And this is where the chart comes in handy. Under 38 U.S.C. Section 3510, it specifically talks about that each person is eligible. And it also states that it's entitled to educational assistance. One part is eligibility, the next part is entitlement. When you get down to 3501, it talks about the eligible person. It only discusses only one person. It's a child of a person with PNT. When you get down to 38 U.S.C. Section 3511.
With P and T?
Permanent in total. That's what
of a person, okay.
Yes, of a person. Because we're referring specifically to Dr. Osmond's situation, I didn't cover the other.
Could I go back? I'm interested in this eligible person concept. Who applies for this benefit?
Dependents' educational system can be applied to by a
spouse. Does the veteran apply?
No, he does not apply for this particular
benefit. Excuse me, but he can, can't he?
Well, I'm asking the secretary.
Yeah. Well, I didn't.
He becomes entitled to the dependent educational assistance, and then he can, then it's transferable down to his spouse or his children.
Oh, but is the entitlement that of the veterans to provide education, or is the entitlement directly to the child to get the benefit?
It's the entitlement to the child.
Why do you say that?
I say that it's based on, because first it says to the each eligible person, and then once you determine the eligibility, then you determine the entitlement. So there's no way that you can get to the entitlement unless you get to the person that's eligible.
That's, that's my question about which is the eligible person. Couldn't you say the eligible person was the veteran? They were entitled to the benefit so that they could provide educational assistance to their children?
If I understand your question here, what you're asking me is if the eligible person is the veteran,
correct,
then the child would then receive the entitlement versus the veteran would be the entitlement?
Mm-hmm.
I don't see it as such as written in the statute.
Well, it just says eligible person. That's why, that's my question. I don't know who, that's not defined anywhere, is it?
In chapter 3501.
Where is it?
The eligible person says a child of a person who died of a service-connected disability or has a total disability permanent in nature. It's the child of the person.
What section is that?
3501.
Okay.
A1. Right.
Okay, you can go ahead now with your chart. Thank you.
Okay. Under 38 U.S.C. section 3511, it's noted in the clause that educational assistance can be no more than or equal to 45 months. Then we look to 38 U.S.C. section 3541.
Well, before I let you go, I'm very curious about the second sentence. If it was totally limited to only 45 months in all instances, why was the second sentence in 3511A1? It was necessary to limit it to 45 months for people who had dual eligibility, was it not? At least spouses who had dual eligibility.
That is something, Judge Castle, that I would probably have to look further into at this time. In terms of that particular section, I focused on what happened after in 2006 as to that section was taken completely out.
Do you know why it was taken completely out?
I think that it did. In terms of what the legislature stated, they had no specific statement. When I did the research on why that particular sentence was taken out. However, the essence of taking that statement out, it is now read to mean that it doesn't matter if you are entitled to benefits based on that one provision of 3501 or any provision of 3501.
Well, couldn't it be read the other way? In fact, when Congress takes a whole sentence out that purportedly had meaning when it was there, that now an eligible spouse who had dual eligibility could get more than 45 months, such that a spouse who received 10 months while her husband was disabled might get an additional 45 months when her husband dies. Is that, could it not be read that way? Otherwise, what's the meaning of having that last second sentence in there? If you read the first sentence the way you said, the second sentence means nothing.
I think that's why they decided to take it out, Judge.
But there's no legislative history supporting that?
No.
Okay.
There's not, as far as that I know of.
Do you agree that statutes are to be read favorably toward the veteran?
Well, it depends upon the actual situation. Well,
if there's ambiguity?
if there's ambiguity, I think Brown v. Gardner has spoken to that. However, in this specific situation, I don't think there's ambiguity in the statute. I think the statute is...
Well, I think we both just presented two different interpretations with regard to the second sentence, which I believe is the definition of ambiguity.
However, we don't necessarily have to read that sentence. I think that sentence is an addition to as well as, but I think the first sentence is the sentence that is applicable to this situation and can be read in isolation. And in this particular situation, as I was stating earlier, if you look to how the framework of Chapter 35 is set up, there's actually evidence that that there should not have been concurrent benefits. For instance, 1 day of entitlement is equal to 1 day, 1 full day of payment. In other words, when you're paid for 1 month of attending school, your entitlement is charged for 1 month. Payment is set by statute for your course pursuit in 38 U.S.C. section 3532, which brings me back to the chart. In order to come up with this framework where the benefits is tied to his education, in 38 U.S.C. section 3541, it talks about the total period of educational assistance is amount as established in section 3511. When you look back to 3511, the only thing that you see is the 45 months. So entitlement is equal to 45 months, which is equal to the educational assistance. In essence, what this does is to say it doesn't matter if appellant would have received his eligibility through his mother or his father. He could have gotten 22 and a half months from his mother, 22 and a half months from his father. He still cannot receive any more than 45 months of entitlement.
That's
and
true.
That entitlement is charged. That entitlement is specifically charged as stated by 38 U.S.C. section 3532, which specifically states that he receives monthly entitlement of $670. So if he were to receive double the benefit, it wouldn't matter.
Let's break it into two things. One is 45 months and 45 added on. All right, that's one.
Okay.
And this argument that you're just presenting, it seems to me, takes one view of sub A1, and it may be the correct view. I'm just pointing out all these issues here. The other one, which I thought you just got to at the end there, is a concurrent payment during the time period. So if you could keep them separate, most of your argument was on why you couldn't get more than 45 months. When you're done with that, if you could then shift and explain to us why you can't get concurrent, that might be helpful.
Okay. Well, as I stated previously, the way that entitlement is charged, you receive 1 day of training charge versus 1 day of entitlement. And that's pursuant to 38 CFR section 21-3045E1I. And what that comes out to is the number of months of benefits you received is automatically tied into your entitlement. So every time you receive 1 month of benefits, you extinguish 1 month of entitlement, which is 45 months. So that answers the first part of the question. The second part as to why there would be no concurrence. Well, in essence, if you look at it in theory, if you were to give him concurrent benefits at the same time, he could receive $670 of entitlement, and then he could receive another $670. But that's 2 months of entitlement.
But why?
Because that's the way it's
why
charged.
Why isn't it 1 month under each through each eligibility status?
It is. That's exactly what I'm saying. It is under each eligibility. It could be, but he still cannot receive any more than 45 months.
What about in counsel's argument that 35? I'm going to write it down. 3562, which specifically talks about non-duplication of benefits, and Congress thought about this, sat up there and said, "Geez, we don't want duplication of benefits." But they said we don't want duplication of benefits between this chapter and others. What about that particular argument as to why you can't get duplication of benefits? Why isn't, how do you answer that? What was Congress's thinking? Why didn't they just put a provision in here that says you can't duplicate benefits under this chapter or any additional chapter?
I think that in the situation that arose here, it didn't, each eligible person, I don't think that you needed to say that once you establish eligibility that you can't receive eligibility twice. In the other situation, you can become entitled under Chapter 30, 32, 34, 36, as well as Chapter 35, and they wanted to make it clear that there was no non-duplication of benefits. And when you look in the Secretary's brief, the Secretary, I've spoken to why what the legislature stated that these benefits were instituted for in the first place. They weren't sent there in order to pay for his entire education. They were set there in order to help assist. They expected for him to make some type of contribution to his education.
So if we didn't have compensation, DIC, pension, and all these other chapters, if all we had was Chapter 35, then Congress wouldn't have needed this non-duplication of benefits because you wouldn't be able to duplicate it anyway.
Yeah.
That's what you're saying?
Yeah. Could I ask a couple questions? As I understand your argument when you started out, it seems to me, I want to clarify this, is the Secretary asking us to rule directly on the validity of the General Counsel opinion and decide the case based upon that and forget about the APA issues?
I think that the court can look at this actually without the GC opinion altogether. I think that the statutes which have been listed, 3510 through 3501, 3511, all the ones that I've stated, pretty much leave no other conclusion, but he can receive 45 months of entitlement.
Right, but we have a board decision here, and the board decision relied on the GC opinion. So the board decision was not in error, because they were bound by the GC opinion. So we have to deal with the GC opinion, right?
Yes.
Okay. Now, again, you want us to rule on the legitimacy of the GC opinion and decide the case that way, or are you asking us to forget about the APA issues?
Well, no. In terms of the, of course, we would say we wouldn't want you to rule on the APA issues. However, in this situation, I think that it's clear that because it's a DC opinion that you would have to rule on that.
Okay. Let me ask you another question, if I could. Is the appropriate legislative history to look at when we're thinking of what the purpose of the legislation was, is it the War Orphans Educational Assistance Act of 1956? Is that the basic legislative history we want to look at when we're determining the purpose of the statute? I mean, the original enactment, I think, of this whole concept went back to that as I see it. Now, do you agree with that? I want to make sure I'm looking at the right legislative history.
Yes, and that's actually in my initial brief to the court, which talks about the war education.
Now, as I understand that, in looking at that legislative history, what Congress was saying was, look, if a child would normally look to their parent for financial assistance to further their education. And because that parent, in this case, who served his country, has a service-connected disability, they are less able, by definition, to provide that financial assistance to the child.
Mm-hmm.
Correct? Are you with me so far?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, it's based, again, on the ability of the parent to contribute. How is it any different? How is that, and the decrease in the disability, the decrease in the ability to contribute is directly based upon the parent's service to this country. And that's why we have this statute. So why is it that we want to disregard the service of the other parent when there are two parents involved here. Both parents in this case serve their country. Both parents have a service-connected disability, and both parents are less able to assist, in this case, their son in his educational pursuits. If that's the purpose, but if you agreed with me that that's the purpose behind the statute, where in the statutory purpose or legislative intent do we disregard the service of one of those parents?
I don't necessarily believe that you are disregarding the service of that parent. I think that the 45 months is just specifically the amount that they've given based on either one. I think.
So you would say that it's 30. That portion of 3511 is what is the portion that the secretary relies on as the limitation. There's nothing. You're not relying on anything else but that provision. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay.
And honestly, in order to get around that one provision, I think that's difficult as well, because it's already been established by statute as to how much he would receive in terms of his benefits.
But see, the problem with that argument is that we must accept the proposition that $670 per month is the total amount that they can receive overall, as opposed to the total amount that they can receive from through the eligibility from each parent. If we took the view that the child is entitled to the benefit from each parent, then you would take 670 times 2. It would be 45 months of 670 and 45 months of 670.
And how do you get past the definition of 3501? I mean, 3510, which says it has to be each eligible person, 3501, where it's a child of a person. It doesn't, he cannot be two people. Mm-hmm. I just don't see how you get past those two provisions and then the provisions where the educational benefit is tied to the actual program for his course. He gets paid $670. For 1 month of entitlement. Entitlement is considered his full-time benefit for the day. There's no way to get around that. And that's why when you look at how this case is, when you go back to look at the definition in 3511, that each eligible person only gets educational assistance for 45 months, you can't get past that and say that he should receive it concurrently.
Well, counsel, I'm sorry. I think that's an interesting argument. And let me offer, the last time I checked, in order to be a child, you had to be a child of two people, not one. So isn't, in fact, a child of a person, and this person could be the child of a mother and a father. That's two people,
yes.
Right? So receiving benefits from each of those people under a concurrent theory is very consistent with the statutory definition. That's one reading of the statute.
But it doesn't say each.
No, a child of a person. Would include both parents, possibly, seems to me. But notwithstanding that, let me ask you a question I asked Dr. Osmond as well, and that is, before GC Opinion 1-2002 was adopted, the Secretary paid concurrent benefits, educational benefits. Is that correct?
Yes, it did. And those
under the same statutory provision?
Yes, it did. One
particular
RO paid the benefit, and there were only three other situations where that occurred, and they were stopped. And that's why they sought the actual DC opinion to make certain that their procedures were consistent with what the statute called for.
And what was the reason for stopping that payment procedure, as far as you understand?
Basically the same thing that I've been explaining to you here. The entitlement is based upon the program. Once they're charged that one amount, they can get no more than 45 months of assistance. They're not in two programs, so every time that they get an indication from the actual school, they get paid for that month.
I accept the limitation for 45 months generally, but I'm not sure it really addresses the concurrent issue, because a concurrent payment or payments could be made from the secretary for both participating veterans, it seems.
Okay, so if you were to give the appellant 670, that's 2 months of entitlement. He still uses up 45 months at the same time. He just receives the benefit faster. He gets no more.
Right, but if he had entitlement under both parents, he would effectively get 248 months concurrently.
The statute once again states that his monthly entitlement, his entitlement can be no more than 45 months. And that's pursuant to 3532. That's statute.
Correct. Right.
And if he had only one parent, his argument would be that he only gets 45 months. But if he had two parents, both disabled, his argument is that he gets 245 months because he's got dual eligibility status. And Congress clearly recognized dual eligibility status in the second sentence of 3511A1, although they subsequently took it out with no explanation.
Dual eligibility in terms of a wife or spouse, but there's no statement in that.
That's true, but it was a limitation with regard to the spouse, meaning no limitation elsewhere.
Just because it doesn't say that there's no limitation doesn't necessarily mean that there isn't a limitation, especially where the statute, once again, speaks to only paying a certain amount of educational assistance.
Ms. White, I have some questions, and before I just like to remind you, like I did Dr. Osmond, the proper way to address the court. I have a couple questions with regard to the APA. I know that this has not been a real focus of our questioning so far, but I'd like to ask you specifically some questions with regard to the general counsel opinion that we're talking about now. Is it the secretary's view that this is an interpretive rule, or how would the secretary characterize the general counsel opinion?
Judge Hagel, it would definitely be an interpretive rule. Looking at the case history on this, it's stated that an interpretive rule is one that clarifies and explains the existing law. And looking at the actual general counsel opinion, the secretary would state that it has done just that.
Let me ask you this. Does it apply generally across the department? Does it bind the entire department?
Yes, it does bind
and
the department.
Does it apply to both claims that are under adjudication and claims that will be in adjudication in the future?
Yes, it does.
Does it tell the regional office as well as the BVA how to adjudicate claims of similar to Dr. Osmond's?
Yes, it does.
Is there any specific delegation to the secretary in the statute to make this determination?
Is there any in the statute to make this delegation?
To delegate to the secretary to determine this particular, concurrent or non-concurrent benefits, or any regulation with regard to this particular statute?
Well, You mean, is it 3562?
Mm-hmm.
That he has to file? Well, you know...
Does it say the secretary will make regulations to implement this, for example, in the statute?
I'm not following exactly what you're asking.
Okay, well, let me just disregard that for a second. Did this general counsel opinion change the way that the VA had adjudicated these types of claims before? In other words, did the VA previously permit concurrent benefits, and then this general counsel opinion changed that and says, no, we're not going to permit concurrent benefits without a change in the statute?
Time's up, but I'll go ahead and answer.
I mean, you attached a letter that indicated that they had previously
They
done
had
it.
Previously adjudicated that for that one for that one regional office, and thereafter, because the situation had come up several times, the Undersecretary for Benefits went to the General Counsel to make a determination as to if they were allowed to pay concurrent benefits. I don't necessarily believe that it was an established policy within the department.
Well, let me ask you this. If you look at page 53, if you'll indulge me, page 53 of the record, and I'm looking at a letter from the regional office in Buffalo. And it seems to me to indicate that this policy is established in January of 2002. It says, please note that effective January 25th, 2002, the General Counsel of the Department of Veterans Affairs determined that Chapter 35 Educational Assistance Allowance may not be paid concurrently to a child by reason of permanent total disability, service-connected disability or death of more than one parent. This determination also limited the number of months a child could receive benefits in two-parent cases under Chapter 35 to 45 months. It appears to me that this implies that this is a change, or that the policy was first established in 2002.
Well, I would have to agree with that statement, okay. Judge Hager.
All right. I have another question.
Thank you very much.
Your Honor, is it possible that I can extend my time?
How much time do you want? Well, that's open-ended, huh?
It actually shouldn't take me that long, probably no more than like 5 minutes to complete with this.
Sure, 5 is enough, because what I give you, you're going to get.
10.
Smart move. 10 minutes.
Looking at, I'm going to change onto the actual GC opinion, and it really has to do with 5 U.S.C. section 552, and whether or not it should be considered as published in the Federal Register. And while there is a lack of publishing of it in the Federal Register, prior to the court getting to that determination, the appellant must demonstrate that he was not affected adversely. And in his brief, he stated that he was affected adversely because he had to receive loans and as well as enroll in medical school. However, in terms of the timeline, the secretary submits that the appellant was not adversely affected by the lack of publication in the FDR, in the Federal Register. First, On April 7, 2003, we received an application based on his father. In the application, he stated...
Is this part of the record?
What, that
is
he
this
received?
Part of the record?
No, it is not. Part of the record as to when he received the information.
No, but you just cited a date and an application, which is something I would assume would be part of the record on appeal. Is it a part of the record on appeal?
No, it is not part of the record of appeal. Recently, Your Honor, I apologize, Judge Fagel. Your Honor, recently, the Secretary actually in the mail, as recent as this week, received in the mail the application of the father's, so I was unable to get that into the record. But it is part of a question that Judge Davis had asked earlier as to when he received his application, so I thought it was best to at least put that before the court. In this application, he said that he wanted to be admitted to either law school or to medical school.
But that application is not in the record?
No, it's not.
No, I don't think you need to read the whole application to us.
No, I'm not going to read the whole application.
Well, I don't think you need to read his intent. It's not here.
Okay. At the time that he received, the whole point of the timeline is the statement that he has been adversely affected because he wouldn't have gone to medical school and he wouldn't have possibly taken out loans. However, when he was approved for this application for medical school, this was before his mother had even received information from VA that she was entitled. She received her notification, which is in the record, on September 20th, 2003, which is a record at 29, that specifically stated that she was seeking this entitlement. In that application, he was enrolled already in medical school on August 2003. It was on November 3rd. He did receive information about the GC opinion, which would have been probably within 23 days of the day that his mother was granted the benefit. So in terms of his statement of being adversely affected, the Secretary does state that he does not believe that the
So this benefit, on record of 29, this benefit went to the mother?
The benefit of October...
The benefit, you just said, his mother applied for, his mother received this benefit.
We received her application October 9th, 2003.
And her application was for what benefits?
DEA.
DEA. Got it. All right, go ahead.
So in closing, the Secretary requests that the court find the DC opinion is valid, find that it is an interpretive rule and exempt from the notice and publication requirements of the APA pursuant to 5 U.S.C. Section 553, find that 5 U.S.C. Section 552 is not for application because the appellant was not adversely harmed and did not demonstrate that he could have pursued another course of action. In the alternative, the court should still affirm, based on the court's de novo review, as the question presented is a question of law.
This last little line of argument here is, I'm not sure it's new because it's referred to in your brief, but I'd like to understand, if I could, that what I hear you arguing is that even if there was error, there's no prejudice. Is that correct?
Exactly.
Now explain to me again how Dr. Osmond was not prejudiced by not being able to get 45 months of additional benefit, or additional 45 times 670.
Well, the issue isn't that he did not receive the 45 months. It was at the time when he filed the application, was he adversely affected by not receiving the publication? He was already enrolled in medical school. He had already taken out, I'm not going to assume, but going to medical school, you need to take out loans, and you stated earlier that he had to take out loans. But the loans probably, since he started in August, he probably had already taken those loans out.
Are you arguing, I guess, similar to, I think it's the Erstbarmer case? I think it's Erstbarmer, where the individual applied, or maybe it's Thies, one of the two, where the individual applied for benefits after he finished his education?
No,
and then the court ruled that he's not entitled to that because the failure to receive benefits did not prevent him from acquiring his additional education. Is that what you're saying? I'm really having a hard time with this. Try to explain it again. It's my inability to grasp this argument. I'd like to understand it so that I can evaluate it.
It's really addressing the question that Judge that the court asked in reference to 5 U.S.C. Section 5.2 as to whether or not there should have been...
He was adversely affected.
If he was adversely affected by the lack of publishing of the GC opinion. And so the Secretary submits that he stated that he was adversely affected because he did not... he had to take out benefits, or he might not have gone to medical school. And the Secretary's position is that at the time that he applied for medical school and possibly for loans, he had no idea that his mother was entitled to DEA.
But during the period, while he was in school, he certainly realized it and did apply for it, did he not? And was he aware at that time about the GC opinion?
And he also had actual notice of the way that VA established eligibility and entitlement.
Okay, and so this goes. I think I understand now. What you're saying is this deals with the APA issue. In other words, that we're saying, hey, even if they were required to publish it, even if they were required to, in Dr. Osmond's case, That doesn't affect him because he had actual knowledge of the VA's interpretation at the time he was eligible and made the application. He may not have agreed with it, but he knew how the VA interpreted it. So lack of publication is not prejudicial with regard to Dr. Osmond. That's what you're saying. That deals with the APA.
Yes, sir.
Okay, I'm sorry if I was so obtuse there, but now I understand what you're saying.
If there are no more questions.
No. No more. Thank you very much. I will also give you a choice again if you want your 5 minutes first, Mr. Osmond, or... I must tell you, I'm taking from this experience that I will not practice medicine. Proceed.
Your Honors, I first want to thank you for your patience with me this morning, as I am not a lawyer. And I don't practice law, so it's very difficult for me to be here pro se. And I'm certainly doing this at no choice of my own, but this case is very important to me. And in the few minutes that I have to address you, Your Honors, I just wanted to quickly clarify one of the statements made by the VA counsel that stating that I was not adversely affected by the VA decision. The actual disability, as claimed by the letter sent to me on behalf of my mother, her disability date is of May 29, 2002, for 100% disability. And as stated by the VA counsel, the application was sent in October 9, 2003. However, between 2003 and 2005, I was attending a foreign medical school in Mexico, in Guadalajara, Mexico. In 2005, I had the opportunity to transfer to Drexel University College of Medicine. And at this point, we were under the impression that these benefits were going to be available to us. Going from tuition from $18,500 per year at Universidad Autónoma de Guadalajara, Mexico, to $38,000 plus at Drexel University College of Medicine, I absolutely would not have gone and made the transfer if the benefits, you know, had been denied and that statement was clear.
And why is it that you believe that you are entitled to the benefits? You said that you were led to, I thought you said you were led to believe, or you, at least you were under the impression you were entitled to it.
Yes, Your Honor. And one of the questions that you posed before about eligibility, who is the eligible person? And now, it's very difficult for me to make comments on laws and prior statutes and things of that nature. However, in any employment, for example, at Jackson Memorial Hospital, I am the eligible person receiving health care benefits. And my spouse can receive benefits under me. However, if I lose my job, I lose the benefits. Everybody loses the benefits. So in this case, I believe that the eligible person, any person eligible, refers to the veteran.
Did you apply for the benefits, or did your parents individually apply for them on your behalf?
This has been a joint effort, Your Honor.
Well, the actual application, who submitted it?
My mother submitted the application for her benefits, Your Honor.
And the same with your father?
Yes, Your Honor.
Who were the payments made to?
The payments were made under my name, Your Honor.
Not in your name.
Who signed the application?
I signed the application, Your Honor.
Both?
Yes.
Did your parents sign the application?
I'm sorry?
Did your parents sign the application, either application?
I don't recall, sir. I'm Your Honor. This case has been going on for a better part of 4 years now. We've got two or three manila folders stacked full of
papers. One of the faster ones, huh?
You could say that, Your Honor.
I'm just kidding.
You can continue.
Okay. That's all I have at this time. Thank you very much for your consideration.
Thank you. Go ahead and start. You get an extra few seconds.
I'd like to first address the adverse effect argument made by the VA.
Let me just get this straight. We have what, 553 and 552, is that right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And this only applies to the 552?
Yes, Your Honor.
That's if it was an interpretation and had to have this type of publication under 552. The rule is 553.
Yes, Your Honor. The substantive versus interpretive rule is 553, and that refers to the notice and comment. 552 only refers to the publication of the rule in the Federal Register.
Got it. Go ahead.
And the rule is published, a summary of the rule, summary of the GC opinion was published in May 5th, 2004. Mr. Osman applied for benefits as to his mother in October 6, 2003, and he was denied benefits on November 5, 2003. So at the time he was denied benefits, that was the first he had ever heard of this rule, and he did not have constructive notice of the rule through publication in the Federal Register. He had already applied and enrolled in medical school. He'd already made decisions about his future.
How was he adversely affected? I'm at a loss. What's the adverse effect? He went to law school.
Medical school.
He fulfilled what he wanted to do.
Your Honor, the question is whether or not he was adversely affected by a rule that was not published at the time. And he was adversely affected when he was denied benefits. He was denied benefits under an unpublished rule, and under the APA
What's the publication got to do with that? I mean, if he's not entitled, he's not entitled to benefits. We didn't publish he's not entitled to benefits. How's he adversely affected?
Your Honor, the APA...
Because he went to school and got a medical degree?
Yes, Your Honor. The whole purpose of the APA is that people should be making decisions based upon rules that they know exist. And if a rule exists that forecloses certain...
So he wouldn't have gone to medical school.
It's possible.
That would be a negative, is what you're telling us. I mean, that's fine. I'm trying to understand it.
Your Honor, I can't obviously get in the head of Mr. Osman and go back at the time. It may well turn out to be a great thing he went to medical school. But the point is that he may have made different decisions. And in his decision-making calculus, he did not have the rule that was in effect. He was not able to look at it. He was not able to understand how that affected his decision-making. And under the APA, it requires that individuals be afforded the opportunity at least to know what the rules are before they make certain decisions that are then affected by the application to the rule to them. And that's really, it's not necessarily adverse in terms of he's now suffering something that, but the point is he made a decision without knowledge of the rule. And that's what the APA requires.
Okay.
Mr. Thompson, let me just clarify the dates that you mentioned. You said he was denied benefits on December 5th, 2003. Is that right? And those were the, was that related to his mother's application?
Yes, Your Honor. November 5th, 2003, he was denied benefits as to his mother.
November 5th, 2003.
Yes, Your Honor.
And you mentioned another date there, the date of the application. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor. That was October 6, 2003.
Okay. And the VA counsel just indicated a different view on the timeline impact on his decision-making process. And I'd just like to make sure I have these dates right. He enrolled in medical school in August of 2003.
Yes, Your Honor.
And there's an application based on his father's eligibility or his father's service in disability status in April of 2003?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you.
And the his mother was injured in, as Mr. Osmond indicated, in May of 2002. So that's when, you know, he might have had the expectation of applying for benefits.
And the focus here is on the impact or the adverse effect of the lack of publication, right?
Yes, Your Honor. The focus is on him making decisions where he was his decisions would be affected by a rule that he did not know about.
Right.
Moving to the legislative aspect, the pushing aside the APA for a moment.
Before you go, do you agree with the Secretary that there's no legislative history with regard to the deletion of the sentence in 3511A1?
Your Honor, I'm not aware of any legislative history. But the VA still cannot point to a single provision prohibiting concurrent benefits. It's reference to the definition of an eligible person.
Well, what do you point that says you can get concurrent benefits? Now that the Secretary, as I understand it, took the view that 3562, which is in the same chapter, non-duplication of benefits, was only necessary because there were other chapters, that it was not necessary with regard to this chapter. So what do you, as I read the General Counsel opinion, what he's saying is, look, there's no prohibition that we can read, but that's because there's no authorization. So where is the authorization for duplication of benefits? Actually concurrent. I mean, remember there's two issues here, concurrent and 45 and 45.
Yes, Your Honor, that's really the...
So the concurrent part, where is the authorization for concurrent?
Yes, Your Honor, that's the problem underlying the whole issue is that there's no authorization, there's no express authorization, there's no express prohibition. It's not addressed expressly in the statute.
All right, well, where is it impliedly addressed in the statute
Your Honor, for
concurrent?
It would be impliedly addressed in areas where Congress has explicitly said that dual benefits are prohibited, but has not done so for Chapter 35. It's also addressed in
but
the...
But that's in comparison to chapters.
Yes, Your Honor, and...
So if I have no other chapters, I mean, you write a non-duplication, this one and the one you cited otherwise... all said between chapters. And the Secretary's view is, well, you don't need one for one chapter. You just don't get duplicate benefits in the one chapter, not concurrent.
Your Honor, that assumes that you don't get benefits, and there's nothing that says you don't get dual benefits. So if there's nothing saying you don't get dual benefits, how can you argue that that section is based upon an assumption that dual benefits would exist otherwise?
Well, I guess I'm looking for the first part. What says you get dual benefits? We all know you get one benefit.
Your Honor, there is nothing expressed that says you get dual benefits.
So do you think we can write a rule that says you can get it?
If this court is to go about figuring this issue out and looking to the statute, it cannot point to any express provision. It would have to point to provisions indicating an intent.
So don't Gardner and all those cases kind of look to the statutes, and we can sit here and say there's no express prohibition, but that doesn't necessarily mean there's authorization. That's the Secretary's point of view and the General Counsel opinion. And I'm still looking from you, and I see we're out of time. So what is there anything else you want to add to what says there is authorization to get dual,
Your Honor,
concurrent
the,
compensation?
The authorization in the statute would be, A, the fact that an eligible person is defined as the child of a person, and that does not indicate whether or not it's, you know, that doesn't say anything about whether, as to each child of, if you're a child of one person, you get benefits, and if you're a child of another person, you get benefits. So that's an area where there's some play where you would resort to the aid and interpretation of that the statute is interpreted to the veteran's benefit. And that's one area. And certainly the only other areas would be congressional intent and the other statutes expressly prohibiting dual benefits. But this whole discussion really underscores the point that it's a substantive rule, that there just isn't, this is filling a gap that doesn't exist. Thank you.
Before you go, do you have anything?
No.
Okay, I have one.
Judge Davis has a follow-up.
Mr. Thompson, the Secretary has taken some effort to put together a chart that, at least in their view, answers the question of this concurrent payment. And I understand that you have a copy of the chart and have had a chance to review it. I'm particularly interested in any thoughts you might have, if any, regarding the argument that the Secretary has made in terms of the 1 day of training charge equals 1 day of entitlement. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Your Honor, to be honest, I received this immediately before the argument.
Okay.
And I haven't had a lot of time to look at it. I've been focusing on the arguments.
Right. That's fine. I don't want to put you on the spot, so it's okay.
Thank you very much. Case submitted. We'll go down. Three parties. Thank you. Thank you.